Say, I'll tell you what, you know, the global living room, where we are now, is only a tough room when you're wrong. And Brother Walt out there has said, please stand corrected. Secretary, its first loss was at Sarasota Racecourse in the Empire State of the Universe on August 4th, 1973. $50,000 Whitney Stakes, 1.25 miles. Good Lord, Walt. Saratoga Racecourse, Sea Link. Okay, I stand corrected. And having been corrected, I am now in the groove. I am now right. Thanks, Walt. I love you people. I really do. We'll be right back with David Hoole in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, here we are again. You know, Mr. Hoole, I was wondering if we could get into this flow to global, the three forces behind the shift a little bit. As I mean, your book is, and I'm serious about this, it is so well written and it's so rich in detail. You really kind of, well, I hate to just jump around in here, so it's like I want to stick with it.
I know it pretty well.
You know? I know you do.
And you know, I got to say something about that, John, because I intend, as you know it, because you know you have that copy that I sent you. I intentionally wrote it so people can jump around and read it. So many books, you know, when I was writing my first book, I asked people, I said, so, you know, there's a couple of big bestsellers, a real thick nonfiction, and people never really read them because they were too big. And I love it when people say, you know, I just picked up your book and I wanted to go read this. I read about that and I felt smarter about that. So, it you know, even though it put a lot of work into it, I tried to make it very accessible and, you know, easy to read for people.
Well, I was looking at it, and I thought, do you dare do this, just jump around? And I thought, well, I'm going to try it. And then you said, no, it's kind of written to be that. So that's good. That's perfect.
Yeah, no, jump around. I mean, you know, it's people who like education go read that first. Women read the Ascendancy of Women chapter right away. You know, that's the point, you know.
Well, as we become more closely connected globally, mm-hmm. what does this portend for the... for those huge masses in what we used to call the third world, some of it's even the fourth world, how do we pull them along with us, or do they become, as the producers, become more connected and more productive, then does that make the situation for the masses of people who are not productive, does it make it worse, or do we kind of pull them along with us?
The answer is both. I'm very fond of saying that the cell phone has created economic leverage in what we used to call the third world for the first time. Oversimplified example. Person lives in a sub-Saharan village in Africa. And for decades, his parents and he, and then he and his wife or whomever, took their craft goods or their agricultural goods and managed to get them by cart or truck 30 or 40 miles down the road to the next biggest town and said, here's my stuff. And that person in that bigger town would lowball them because he knew that there was no option for this person. Now, with a cell phone, this villager in this small sub-Saharan village gets on the phone and calls the three biggest towns around him and says, what do you pay me? What do you pay me? What do you pay me? And so it's part economic leverage. And the interesting thing, here's a statistic, you know, it's about cellular technology versus other infrastructure. Cell phones have been around roughly, you know, commercially available for 30 years. Electricity has been commercially available, obviously first and largely in the United States, for 133 years. Yet at this moment, there are more humans that have cell phones than have electricity in their homes.
That's unbelievable.
So, you know, it to me, it's really leveling the playing field. It is letting everybody participate. Now, granted, that villager in sub-Saharan Africa doesn't have an iPhone. They probably have a cheap, old, refurbished phone that somebody in America probably used 10 years ago.
Yeah, they're probably better off without it.
Well, you know, you can buy cell phones in India for $5.
No kidding.
Right? There's no plans, you know, and it's half a cent a minute or something. I mean, so when you think about that, and you go back, you know, you always have to put the present moment in the context of the future and of the past. You know, 200 years ago, maybe only 10% of the people alive on the planet were literate. And, you know, even it wasn't until 1956 that there was a transatlantic cable for international phone calls. So, you know, it's only in the last 50 years that we've been able to make, quote, international phone calls. And now you can pick up the phone if you have the right calling pack and you know the right number to dial. You can talk to anybody, any place in the world at any time. So that villager or that poor person or that, you know, family living in poverty, if they have a cell phone, they can be connected. And the other thing that gets that I really get amped about is the accelerated connectors to the planet eviscerates ignorance. I mean, I said in 2008 that within 3 to 5 years, there would be upheaval in dictatorships and in autocratic Islamic states because of the accelerated connectors to the planet. And I didn't know to call it Arab Spring. I didn't know what was going to happen in the spring. But John, the two common denominators of every single, and it's clear an ongoing, you know, revolution, but the two common denominators of every single country of Arab Spring was, one, accelerated electronic connectedness. Facebook and Twitter were the tools of revolution. And two, 45 to 55% of the population was under the age of 25. So you put young people and connectedness together, you have Arab Spring. So, you know, if you think about it, dictators and sect leaders survive by keeping information out, like North Korea, right, or Iran, or any place like that. Or religious leaders only read the Quran, right, and they keep all other information out. Well, it's pretty hard to do that when everybody's getting connected. I mean, what is that 10-year-old girl in Saudi Arabia going to say to her mom now that she sees pictures of other 10-year-old girls not having to be covered from head to foot? She goes, "Mommy, why do I have to do that?" Right, because she can see. She's connected.
You know, I talk to Persian people all the time, and they all say the same thing, and that is that it's the government that's so fanatical. The young people of today don't care about they're not as interested in other things besides what the government would have you think everybody over there is interested in. And I think you must be absolutely positively correct, because it is this connectivity and the access to the internet and the exposure to new ideas and everything else that's sort of changing the paradigm, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on something there. I think, you know, I touch on it in my book. Again, if you're in the global stage of human evolution, then the concept of the nation state is in decline. In other words, the Industrial Revolution, 300 years, is basically the time of nation states. Before that, it was monarchies and territories and fiefdoms and, you know, city states. And then we had the nation states. And now it's kind of, we're becoming much more global. I mean, the phrase national leader is almost oxymoronic, right? I mean, you know, they don't know what to do in Europe. And in the United States, it's like, what do the polls say? So it's the people are now leading. So I think, you know, one of the things, and I'm not sure exactly how it's exactly going to take shape, but I know that it will. It's kind of a lessening in authority of nationalism and more of an emphasis on globalism. Like, I think of myself as a global citizen. Of course, I travel around the world. But increasingly, I meet people, you know, when I'm in Australia or I'm in South Africa or I'm in South America that, you know, think of themselves as a global citizen. They live here and they live there. And that's going to increase. And when that increases, then there's more of a sense of orientation towards all of us rather than just these people who are of the same citizenry that I am.
Well, is it too fanciful to even suggest that somehow national sovereignty will survive, but it'll be at a more dignified and less aggressively defensive in its nature than it is now, because we'll be compelled. In other words, the French can still be French,
right.
No problem, but there's a lot of interaction here, and so we won't just get so haughty with each other and do all that saber rattling that eventually comes from, you know, I keep looking back in history thinking a lot of nations who were each other's best trading partners have routinely gone to war with each other. So I just wonder how this will play out politically.
I think there's a good chance that the optimistic way you started to describe that is going to happen. You know, when you think about it, there's a lot of, you know, the media, as you know, amps up all the negativity. But if you take the total number of people who are alive today on the planet, 7.1 billion, and the total number of people who will die, say, last year due to armed conflict, the relationship between those two numbers is at a historic all-time low. For example, in World War II, over an eight-year period, you know, from the late 30s to the mid to late 40s, so you include Mao and Stalin, 80 million people lost their lives, and there was 1.6 billion people on the planet, which means it's 5% of all of those people who were alive in the world were killed due to World War II. If that same number would happen today, it'd be 350 million over a 10-year period, which means 35 million people a year would be dying in war. But so you again, you have to look at it in a larger perspective. So it's much. I think there's a lot of danger out there. I mean, I'm not Pollyanna, but I do think that nation states increasingly think about how we celebrate our legacy. It's July 4th. People get dressed up and sing Yankee Doodle Dandy. And then the rest of the time, you got to go to museums and see it. So I think that the innate, you know, national cultures, the French culture, the German culture, are getting less distinct. And so nation states are going to preserve them. That's going to be part of their role. I mean, you go into Amsterdam today versus when I went there in the 70s, it looks completely different in terms of the population, the demography, the races, and everything. Same thing even in the United States, right? So we're getting much more integrated globally than we ever have been before. And I hope that leads to peace, you know, greater peace. There'll always be somebody wants to kill somebody. I mean, I don't think that's going to go away completely.
I don't know. Maybe it'll eventually be bred out of us.
Well, that would be nice to think.
You know, to take the murder part out, you know, don't let it all turn into just like we can't even go out into the air because we're so fragile. But, you know, let's take the desire to destroy other people. Let's see if we can weed that out a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, then.
I hope so. See, one of the things that's going to happen is, you know, in my book, I talk about, you know, the context, the five contexts of the shift age, and we can pick that up. I know time's short for the break here, but one of them is the Earth century. And Marshall McLuhan, one of my intellectual heroes, said it best. He said, there are no passengers on spaceship Earth. We are all crew. And that's going to become really apparent to almost everybody alive on the planet over the next few decades, that this is our spaceship. And so we collectively, globally, we have to protect it. I'm not just talking about environment. I mean, we all now know that when a coal-powered power plant comes on China, we ultimately breathe some of that air. So once we start realizing how interconnected we are and how reliant we are on everybody helping everybody here to preserve what we've got, that inevitably will lead to more cooperation, coordination, and less conflict. I mean, you look at the world today, and I don't think it's nationalism as much that's causing conflict as it is religion. If you think about it, you know.
Marshall, yeah. Marshall McLuhan, this is just a quick side trip, but wasn't the expression the medium is the massage rather than the medium is the message?
He said both, John. His first phrase was the medium is the message. And then he put out, and he was a real dense writer. And somebody said, you got to put out a book that's more, you know, indicative visually of what you're saying. So he put out a book in 1967 called The Medium is the Massage.
Okay, now I've got it.
Okay.
All right. All right, swell. So he said it both ways.
He did. And when you think about that, the medium is the message, basically, for your listeners was, you know, if you're watching one TV show and I'm watching another, that's a less relevant fact than the fact that we're both watching television, right? In other words, the watching of the television is a more significant fact than the content we're watching. When you think about this day in the internet, we're getting massaged by the screen reality, right? So, I mean, it's even much more distinct. So the medium is the message, and we're all online. There you have it. You know? So I got to say one thing real quickly here. I wanted to say this conversation is so fun. I've already gotten some emails from listeners who said, thank you. I've listened to you for half an hour in Coast to Coast. I'm going to get your book. And they've gone to my website, davidhull.com, and sent me an email. I've already responded to a couple of them. So it's really, and I get a lot of Facebook likes, and it's really, so it's really nice to be live with you and have people actually responding to me on their screens. I mean, that's how connected we are.
That's excellent. And I'll tell you what, and there's no patronizing here. This is the best audience on this or any other planet. That they are sharp and they are interested and they are with it. They want to be with it.
Well, it seems so. It's a little past my bedtime, but I'm glad to be part of this audience that they're so responsive. And
well, we just do mind candy and, the buffet of buffoonery during the day.
I mean, right, exactly.
You get stuff done in the middle of the night. During the day, it's like, whatever. They're never going to come on any major news outlet and say there's been absolutely no tragedy or angst on the entire planet today. We're going to go immediately to weather. They're not going to do that.
And if they do go to weather, they'll go to the catastrophe somewhere. Right?
Well, you remember when we were kids, it was all car crashes and stuff. They even had car crash magazines with those ghastly black and white photographs. It's just like, I remember even as a child going, where am I? What planet is this?
Well, Don Henley had the song Dirty Laundry,
Yeah, absolutely true.
Right. Speaking of which, before we can run away real quickly, I love listening to your voice. I had the privilege of representing, working with Bill Curtis. I'm sure you probably heard of him. And he had and he was actually the voice of God in the Ron Burgundy Anchorman movie. And yep. It's like listening to you. It's like the voice of God speaks.
Oh, thanks. I think it came from smoking grapevine in the storm drains with in the second grain with this other delinquent. Do people even know who Marshall McLuhan and Alvin Toffler are anymore?
They do if they listen to me. I feel I'm very open about the fact people say, what a shape you're thinking. And I very humbly say I stand on the shoulders of Marshall McLuhan and Alvin Toffler primarily, and Buckminster Fuller a little less so. I'm standing on their shoulders looking ahead into this century, because they did such a good job of looking ahead, in the 1960s and 1970s to the rest of the last, the remainder of the 20th century. Sometimes when I get off on it and I'm talking to an audience, I said, raise your hand if you've ever read any Alvin Toffler. And less than 5% of the people raise their hands. And so I get to say, well, you're not going to have any, it'll be valuable time reading Alvin Toffler. He's still, we all have our heroes. He's one of mine, as is McLuhan.
It's interesting. You remember that movie remember Future Shock, of course, and it was narrated by Orson Welles. He was doing the swelling and towering thing. And, everything from the different colored hair, so much of that, we're living it now, that movie made back then. It seems so, come on, you got to be kidding me. It's like, well, no, it's practically 100% of it has come to pass. And then I read Future Wars or Future War. And that was quite an eye-opener as well. Toffler is a true visionary.
He is. And real quickly, if we have a moment, I've had the delight to meet him a couple of times. One time I met him in a hotel in L.A., and he had a Japanese TV crew. And I ran back up to my room, and I got his book. It had just come out. It was 2006. It was Revolutionary Wealth. And I stood, and he saw me, and I pulled out the book, and he signed it. And he said, you got a book to sign. And I just was like a fan. I said to him, Dr. Toffler, this takes me back to when I was 13 years old and I had Mickey Mantle sign my own Mickey Mantle baseball card when he was getting off a team bus. And he's so delighted in that we sat down and spent an hour having coffee together. It was a moment in my life. I mean, when you meet a hero,
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's fantastic. Well, I don't think that I'm gushing here, but I'll tell you, you have refined and focused the stuff that came forward from McLuhan and from Toffler, and you put your own perspective into it, and it's just an excellent piece of work, in my opinion. Entering the Shift Age by David Houle, H-O-U-L-E, davidhoole.com, evolutionshift.com. We've still got a good piece of time tonight for our chat, and we'll be back. This is Coast. Well, when we come back with David Houle, let's talk about energy. Where are we going to get it? Are we going to run out? Or are we smart enough to come up with some new ideas? Is there such a thing? I'm not even going to ask if he thinks there's anything as free energy. Obviously, there is. But, you know, can we, like, light our houses with it? Choice, individual choice, greater than ever before. Control. I'd like to get his opinions on everything from world monetary to world government. The collapse of legacy thinking as we make our way. We've got another hour and a half. If he'll put up with it, I sure will, because I think it's fun. I think it's interesting. And according to your emails, many of you do too. In fact, I would say 99.9%. Because the other point, one, is spam. All right, we'll be right back. Stand by, please. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. David Houle, as I just go from back to front, is looking all these tidbits and going, good grief, how can I ask him all of this? One thing came to mind, and it is, there are two kinds of freedom, at least that I can think of at this moment. The one that helps us evolve and produce a good life, as the philosophers were seeking a true definition of what makes a good life. And then there's the other freedom, where we're all so free, we're running around killing each other. Yours is an optimistic viewpoint, but we see conflict all over the world. You mentioned in your book here the threshold years after World War II and then going up through the Cold War and all of that, where it seems like it suggests to me that it's like, okay, we've taken this about as far as we can go, so maybe everybody ought to just back off and we'll just hold each other at bay. And yet there's conflict all over the world. Not all over the world, but certainly all over the Middle East. Do you see this calming down in the future? And what will be the thing that calms it down? Will it be economically driven, or will there be a mentality shift?
I think the latter. I think it's a mentality shift. And you know, you say the Middle East, and if I can kind of go off on that one a little bit, you know, I always say the phrase Middle East peace is an oxymoron. I've never known it in my life. There have been truces, but all my life, people have been killing each other in the Middle East. Now, the root of that is the fact that the map of the Middle East was set between 1914 and 1918 by a bunch of Europeans. It was arbitrary. I mean, you know, you see these right angles on the map. Well, you know, what is that?
Guess who drew those?
Yeah, right. And so that leads me to this is a way to answer your question. On 010110, January 1st, 2010, I coined 2010 to 2020 the transformation decade. Definition of transformation in the dictionary: a change in nature, shape, character, and form. So this is the decade where most of humanity's institutions are going to change their nature, shape, character, and form. And that leads me to this point, answering your question, is that this is the first decade of 21st century thought. Because we've powered into this century with the legacy thinking of the last century, as we talked about earlier. And I, you know, say to your listeners, just think about whatever the phrase 20th century means to you. You know, the American century, century of World War, century of science. All of it began between 1914 and 1918. World War One, Russian Revolution, general theory of relativity, the map of Europe, the map of the Middle East, unfortunately. So all of the storylines we look back on for the last 100 years began in the second decade of the 20th century. So the answer to your question is, it is what we do between now and 2020 that will largely shape it. I think that historians in, you know, 100 years from now, they look back and go, this is the decade where they started thinking 21st century thought. So I truly believe and feel strongly, you say I'm optimistic, and I do have an optimistic view. There is a negative side to all of this too, but I feel that if I can help people see that it's in our hands to redirect and that we can do it, and it's going to happen in this decade, you know, to the degree that people can read my book, that can hear me talk, you know, it really makes my day, John, when people come up to me after I talk and go, you've given me hope, or I'm going to parent my child differently, or now I'm much more positive about raising my children. I mean, that is a profound thing for people to say. You know, and Fuller, Buckminster Fuller, 30 years ago, said that humanity is coming to the fork in the road. One road is utopia, the other road is oblivion. So, you know, we're not out of the woods. We're never going to be out of the woods, metaphorically speaking. But I think
that's just how it is. We have to participate. It's a constant gardening situation.
Right. You can stand on the sidelines and complain all you want, you know, but if you're not playing the game, you're a spectator. And if you're not crew, you're a passenger, you know. One interjection I got to make, because I sit here and listen to the breaks. Do you pick your music for the show?
I do.
Great. I love it. I'm sitting there going, oh, man, Old Tull, this is great. So thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome.
To your selections, you know?
I'm glad you like it. Yeah, some of that stuff gets pretty wild sometimes, but hey, why not? It's nothing to bust a gut over. It's just music, right?
Right.
Well, what do you... You know, everybody's been in a twist over this healthcare thing.
Right.
It appears we now have a plan that is unaffordable, but whatever, we'll try it anyway, even though the numbers aren't going to work. They're not working, but let's try it anyway. Well, what do you see as far as, I mean, I'm hearing more, you know, just keep it on the positive side, because, you know, I got that Pisces thing going where it's like, you know, I got the light side and the dark side. I'm seeing more and more... doctor-assisted euthanasia or suicide was the word. I was trying to avoid it. Is becoming more prevalent. How do you see healthcare and medicine in the future? Or do you think there are technological innovations coming that will shift this paradigm also? Because it's beginning to look like, oh, you're old and worn out. Go ahead and get out of here.
No, it's going to be just the opposite. I wrote my third book, and I mean, should finish my fourth book. My third book was The New Health Age, The Future of Healthcare in America, and it came out just a little more than a year ago. And the reason I wrote that book with my co-author, Jonathan Fleece, who is a prominent healthcare attorney, is simply that the conversation around healthcare in this country is driven by fear, misinformation, and manipulated by politicians. In any conversation that has those three components is a stupid conversation. So Jonathan and I decided to write an intelligent book. So let me just oversimplify it, because of that, everyone's scared, they're being manipulated, there's death squads, there's this and that. You know, think about everything that we've been talking about, okay? Connectivity, electronic files, transparency, search. And round up the 18% of our GDP to 20% that is to healthcare. And so, I've mentioned that in both books, it's the 80-20. So think of healthcare reform as all the stuff that we expect in the 80% of the GDP is now coming to the 20%. I'll give you an example. I spoke to a group of about 400 people just about a year ago in Dallas. It was a healthcare group, you know, Fortune 500 companies, HR execs. And I said, raise your hand if you've ever gone online to do price-related research, doing search before you make a major purchase, like a car, a television set, a washer dryer. And 100% of the hands went up. I then said, raise your hand if you've ever gone online to do price-related research and search for a major medical procedure. Not one hand went up. Why? Because it's not transparent, you know? And this was in Dallas, okay? And there's three hospitals in Dallas that this company that was sponsoring me was talking about. One of them charges $40,000 for open-heart surgery and has a 1.9% mortality rate of over 5 years. Another hospital charges $30,000, 1.6 mortality. And another hospital charges $23,000 and has a less than 1% mortality. Now, if you could search that, where would you go? Right? So all of that stuff that we expect and demand, you know, let's say you have a branch bank, you know, I'll just say Bank of America, first thing pops in my mind. And you, John, you know, your local banker, and you go in there, hey, John, how you doing? And then you're across town one day, and you go into another Bank of America, and they go, I don't know you, here's a clipboard, fill out your information. right? You kind of go, wait, are you kidding me? But how often that's why you left, right? You do it every single time you go into a doctor's office, because only 24%, maybe it's 25% now, of all medical records are digitized. They're in paper folders. You know, I mean, you wouldn't use a bank that didn't have electronic records. So, in my Entering the Shift Age, I say healthcare is going to be called health management. You know, we all heard that phrase, ounce of prevention, pound of cure. Well, we live in a pound of cure healthcare system. And so all of the economic drivers are going to move towards managing your health and being healthier. You know, and if you're not, you're going to pay more. And that's just yes. So I think we're going to be calling it health management by 2020. So I'm very optimistic. And then, let alone what you talked about, medicine. Yeah, sure, there's, you know, but there's bionics that are going to be better than the parts we were born with. I mean, I wear glasses. I don't know if you wear glasses, but...
Wearing them now.
Yeah, right. I have mine on now. And it's like, literally in 3 years, medical science should be able to say, John and David, tell you what, we'll take out those two orbs you have respectfully in your head, and we'll put in some eyeballs with a 15-year warranty of 20/20 vision. I mean, it's that close.
Well, I certainly hope they build in, you know, some, hope it's not like looking at a cyborg, you know. You know, make them realistic, please.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, the joke I say about this is, you know, and it came out in the 2012 Olympics last year. But in 2008, there was this guy, his name was Oscar Pistorius, and he was a sprinter, and he was from South Africa, and he was born with no fibula, so he had fake legs from his knees down to his, you know, from his knees down.
Wow.
And he made the South African Olympic team, but he was disqualified by the International Olympic Committee because not having legs gave him an unfair advantage over those that did. So think about that. This is the decade where replacement parts are going to start to be better than the parts we're born with.
Well, that's about like telling a basketball player you can't play because you're too tall.
Yeah, right.
Stupid.
You know, the $6 million man is now the, I don't know what it's going to cost, but, you know, that is around the corner. And then there's these nanotechnology things where instead of, you know, we've all known somebody's had cancer and had to go through chemotherapy. And it's just tragic what happens because you got to kill off so much of the body to get the cancer. Now you will swallow something, you know, because based on your genetic code, will go right to that cancer and deal with that cancer and leave the rest of your body alone. So I think we're on a threshold of medical miracles. And then, of course, they're going to be expensive initially. Everything is expensive initially until it scales up. But I'm
technology supposedly gets cheaper. Sorry.
Well, here's what I've been saying since 2011, John, that when healthcare reform passes, the costs are going to go up before they go down because you've got the legacy system in place and you've got these new systems coming online. So you've got like dual systems competing in a way. And so prices are going up. They're going up now, right? But I think by 2015, 2016, the overall health care expenses in the United States will start to go down. And by 2020, we'll look back and kind of go, yeah, we did it. So, I mean, this is not a political thing I'm saying. I mean, please, any of your listeners, health is not political. You know, it's your health. You know, so we all want to be healthy. And, you know, being a Democrat or being a Republican, both, you know, whatever you are, you want to be healthy. So...
Yes.
The fact that it got politicized is unfortunate.
Well, all right. The money factor.
Right.
That's a problem. Because I think it is, I think the love of it really is the root of all evil. So I'm just wondering how much, you know, you just said that it's going to be expensive at first, but then as time goes by, it'll get less expensive and more, we'll have better access to it.
Right.
But
so I think, if you think about the system, there's very few other parts of our economy that are constructed where you don't know how much you're going to have to pay. You don't know whether you're covered. You don't know if you're going to be okay. And the person who is treating you is in opposition to you and in opposition to the third-party payer, which is the insurance company. You know, my co-author, Jonathan, from the New Health Edge, I don't know the name of the company, and I'm not sure. I get confused in these small Eastern European countries. I think it was Latvia. There's like 3 million people. And they have a software in place. You know, the whole concept is, you know, the doctor puts in for more more than he expects to get paid for the insurance company. And the insurance company takes a month and sits, you know, before they pay, and then the doctor comes back and bills you. All that is done with Selfert in a matter of minutes. So you're at the doctor's office, he puts in a procedure, he gets paid in minutes, a matter of minutes later. So it all gets connected. And once it gets connected, then you don't have the fraud of the overbilling. You don't have the, you know, there are 180,000 codes before Obamacare passed, 180,000 codes for doctors to get paid. They're all procedures, which is why when you go into a doctor's office, let's run this test, let's run this test. Now, a lot of that, of course, is to avoid getting sued, and it's, you know, there's the tort reform on that side. But nevertheless, there wasn't a single code that doctors would get paid for keeping their patients well. And now that's part of the mix. So
it's interesting.
Yeah. So we're going from the pound of cure to the ounce of prevention. Again, I try to oversimplify things. Now, the health care bill, the Accountable Care Act, just like anything else that Congress puts out, is a mess. It's jerry-rigged. There's special interests in it. It's just that the spotlight was on this one because of the politicians. But, you know, so it's going to be changed. There isn't a major piece of legislation that goes through Congress that doesn't to some degree get altered a bit and refined. And so that's going to happen to this as well. But, you know, people shouldn't get their, you know, all bent out of shape about it. It doesn't have anything to do with your political persuasion. It has to do with your health. It has to do with the future of America, too. Because we pay much more for health care than any other country in the world does on a per capita basis, and we're less healthy.
Yes.
So I'm optimistic on that one.
Well, well, I have a compound question here, and we're down to about 2.5-3 minutes. But what has to collapse before the shift can be complete, or at least close enough to completion where we recognize the difference in our reality of living, and how rough do you think it'll be?
I think it will be easy and rough, depending on who you are and where you are and at what stage you're at. I think that there is, as I said in the book, this connectedness, this cyberspace, this neurosphere, I call it, like the biosphere, only the neurosphere, the neurological aggregate of all our brains, is a technological model for a new consciousness that will start to occur in the 2020s, where we'll start to connect on a consciousness level. I mean, we're moving in that direction. I could give you some really cogent arguments for that. But I think that what has to happen is some of this legacy thinking has to fall away. You know, in politics, it's clear. In government, it's clear. We just have to really, one of the things I say we're going to have to do, one of the contexts of the 21st century and the shift age, is retrofitting the 20th century. That's why we're so stuck. You know, the metaphor is if you take a time-lapse photography picture, if you had a camera and January 1st, 1000, January 1st, 1100, et cetera, up to January 1st, 1800, took a picture of wherever you are right now, right? Mm-hmm. Up until about 1800, you wouldn't see it, much of anything. There's natural beauty. Then around 1900, oh, yeah, there's horse and buggies, there's some roads, and there's some buildings, you know? And then January 1, 2000, we paved the planet. The problem with the 20th century for us is that we quadrupled, almost quintupled, our population in 100 years. We've never done that.
I'll tell you what, when we come back after our little top of the hour break, let's talk about energy. Let's pick it up right there where you left off.
I'm waiting for a good song.
All right. David Houle is our guest tonight, first-time guest on Coast to Coast AM. His book, Entering the Shift Age.